Six music.
Discover more mixes from Six, from some of our favourite and most exciting artists on the BBC Sounds app.
BBC Radio.
BBC Radio Six
music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with David Holmes.
C'est les 69 Police qui vient au théâtre. À bientôt. Ça doit les agiter assez bien. Il y a beaucoup de flics freaking comme les 69 Police autour d'ici. On regarde les chaussures italiennes et le poudre vert. Il y a droit de se démonter.
Un film en technicolor de Warner Brothers.
Les cours de 120 commencent à se déployer à San Francisco. C'est les 69 Police.
Et ça va. Première fois. J'arrive.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. In this episode, we focus on the life and career of an artist born in Belfast, but whose music has had an impact across the globe. First as a DJ, then as a remixer, producer and solo artist, to becoming a hugely respected and talented movie and TV soundtrack composer, to his current status, leaping between all those disciplines, guided only by his passion and enthusiasm. I'm very pleased to welcome to The First Time, David Holmes. In this show, we talk about David's upbringing in Belfast, the raucous family and eclectic musical atmosphere that set him on his path to be a DJ, something he started very young indeed, but also the violence and danger that were part of a childhood in the midst of the Troubles. We also cover his first club nights, and he's kind of legendary Acid House Night, Sugar Sweet, and his first solo record, 95's This Film's Crap, Let's Slash the Seats, plus his soundtrack work for people like Michael Winterbottom, Steve McQueen and Steven Soderbergh, who he's worked with on over 10 films, not least the famous Ocean's heist movies. And of course, we'll hear his musical choices, including Dexys, Farley Jack Master Funk and Ennio Morricone, like I said, eclectic, and his own tunes like the iconic I Heard Wonders and the track you just heard, the brilliant 69 Police. But I started by asking David, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, I grew up in a really rowdy household, so there was like music all around, like all the time. The soundtrack was amazing in my house growing up, you know, because I, youngest of 10, of course, you know, and I was a complete accident, so everyone, you know, all my sisters and brothers were much older, so they were all teenagers and stuff, so I grew up around so much amazing music, from the Sex Pistols to Simon Garfunkel, Irish traditional music, to like film scores like Midnight Cowboy and the Beatles, and you know, it was just,
it's all there straight away, isn't it? Let's be honest,
it was all there straight away. Exactly. I was just, you know, I was going to school without actually realizing it, you know, but I was just always sort of drawn to it. And we had one of those big old gramophones,
all the ones that are like a sideboard.
Yeah,
yeah,
where you could stack the 7 inches. I had this amazing education, such a varied education as well, you know, like everything from like Thin Lizzy, the Rolling Stones, like Clash, the Adverts, you know, the Damned. It was all there for me. So I just really responded to it.
Was there like a specific 7-inch or a specific track you can remember getting a bit obsessed with when you were little?
Gary Gilmore's Eyes by the Adverts.
Right.
Pretty Vacant by the Sex Pistols. Tommy Gunn by The Clash. All Around the World by The Jam. You know, this is just the music that was lying around my house.
Yeah.
Why do you think that stuff? Because that's all pretty aggressive, it's pretty upbeat, it's pretty direct.
I've always had like a really emotional reaction to music. It's always hit me that way. I suppose that's why I do film scores, you know. I don't think it's possible to analyse at that age why you get this visceral reaction to music. But I'm sure it had something to do with being the youngest of 10. And even though all this music belonged to my family, it kind of felt like mine, you know. I just loved the energy or the, you know, the emotional, visceral reaction that you get from music. And I'm sure growing up where I did grow up, right in the centre of Belfast, you know, in the 70s, it wasn't, definitely wasn't normal environment to grow up in. But, you know, I always feel really just blessed and privileged that I grew up in a family and we all loved each other. So even though that we didn't have anything, you know, it was like 10 kids in terrace house, you know, 3-4 bedrooms, everybody doubling up on single beds, bunk beds, you know, the people were everywhere. And we had a dog and my mum and dad. But it was just, it was great crack, as they say, you know, just people queuing to get into the bathroom. But
all day, every day.
Yeah, but there'd be always parties in our house.
Right.
And my mum, she actually didn't drink, but loved having parties. I was just at the centre of all these kind of grown-ups all the time and just playing all this great music. And
so you've got this incredibly eclectic and brilliant world of music. You're connecting music with parties, fun, groups of people dancing. It was inescapable.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose like punk to the new wave music, that was like my first obsession as a kid. My elder sister, Maggie, she was like 19 when I was born. She was in art school in Manchester, and then she moved to London in 1969, seen the Stones at Hyde Park, did the whole punk thing. So she would come home every Christmas with these, like a suitcase for her clothes and another suitcase that was just packed with culture. And she'd bring me back records. She brought me back the 12-inch version of Anarchy in the UK, the French edition. You know, so I was getting all this stuff, and, you know, she made me a pair of brown PVC trousers when I was sort of like 9 or something, you know, and I couldn't put them on and like in front of my dad, you know, because my dad was like a teenager in the 30s. So I was like, right, daddy's coming home, get the PVC trousers off, you know, get the hair back to the way it was. So I was just this wannabe sort of punk, but, you know, didn't even understand what it meant. But I think I must have understood that it was different, and you were a bit of a peacock if these are the clothes that you wanted to wear but really couldn't. But then at the dawn of the 80s, we all got introduced to the world of cinema through the VHS or Betamax, and I just consumed so much film. Back in those days, you could go to someone's house and rent out a video. So I was watching lots of films that I maybe shouldn't have been watching.
I remember the same, because we're kind of the same generation, the generation of the VHS movie store and your friends copying stuff on VHS. And it probably would have been my 12th birthday. I had a like party with just friends, and we watched like Death Race 2000 and Rollerball. And like, you're thinking, these are not acceptable, not video nasties, but like stuff that was not acceptable for kids in the 80s. But we all had access to it. And with those films, often are these amazing soundtracks.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was always into music. I've been through like lots of obsessions, but I was always into music, like period, whether it was a pop record or a soundtrack or something quite, you know, obscure and rowdy. And growing up in Belfast, we didn't have any money, but there were only certain periods where you were allowed out. Sometimes you just weren't allowed across the door. So I just ate up every film that I could get my hands on, you know, and one of those films was Quadrophenia, and that completely changed my life.
Is that one of the proper key ones then, that melding of music and visuals?
In the teenage years, like the early teenage years, that was, I want to be a part of this, you know. I've always been in the gangs and gang films, like, you know, The Wanderers and The Warriors were two of my favourite films growing up, and Assault and Precinct 13. I just sort of like that danger element, but also with these just these weird-looking, dark-looking creatures with uniforms going into like sort of really dangerous sort of neighborhoods and a lot of violence and sex, of course, you know, when you're that age, you're just like, oh my God. I was just left alone to watch all these films. house was bombed, so we moved half a mile up the road, which sounds bizarre, but actually where we were living, we were a sitting target, really. And then we just moved, like, literally a five-minute walk where we felt so much more safer. But we lived in a bigger house then. My mum and dad bought that house, which, like, I had my own bedroom. So I was able to just watch a lot of things that I maybe shouldn't have been watching.
Yeah.
Movies like Midnight Cowboy, for instance, that also had a real profound effect on me. Watching those films like Quadrophenia, Midnight Cowboy, and then at the very center of it, you've got these subcultures and a real scene going on. And, you know, that was like, that's the world I want to occupy.
So what about going to a gig then? Was there a seminal gig experience?
Yeah, I went to see Dexy's Midnight Runners.
Nice.
And I was the kid at the front, pogoing, and it was mind-blowing. Like,
where was that?
In the Ulster Hall.
Right.
I think I was about 12, 13 when that happened. Because that was like, I had to go into town, you know. And that was before the mod thing. I was obsessed with Dexys.
Yeah. A gang again, though. They look like a gang.
They look like a gang. I still love the band, you know. I still listen to those records. There's more than one thing I need to ask you. Yes, 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 you're so anti-fashion, so endless. Instead of dressing down all the same. What I distinctly remember, because I'd never heard music that loud before, because my sister Maggie, she bought me my first Walkman.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a cassette for Searching for the Youngest of Rebels. And I remember putting the Walkman on for the first time and just going, they're like, people are like living in your ears.
And I can go anywhere. This is mine. I can walk anywhere with this song.
Yeah, it was just the novelty of it. When back and I look where we are now, I mean, it's hilarious. But it's when you do something for the first time, that was what was so amazing about Acid House, because we were all doing it for the first time. Obviously, that's many years later, but that really felt like our 1960s, like the mod movement, but the first time. You know, it wasn't something that had been going on for a generation.
Yeah. You owned it. It was yours.
That's what it felt like. But one of the things that was really interesting about Acid House is growing up in the 80s, I used to go to clubs that catered for, like, I did the mod thing, and that was just really exciting and amazing. And that's when I started DJing for the first time.
Because the legend is you were like 15 or something like that. Is that true?
That's 14, 15. But I was always a big lump, you know, like, I was quite tall. Like, I mean, like, when I was in the first, second year at school, I was taller than a lot of the other kids. So I could blag my way out. But things started early. The club would start about 7. And it'd be over at midnight, so I'd go down on the bus and just sneak into town with my dead man suit that I got in St. George's Market. The place was called the Abercorn, and the only reason why I got asked to DJ is because I had good records.
Yeah.
Because DJ didn't turn up, Mark Lavery, he wasn't well. I says, will you play? And I was like, yeah.
Do you remember what you played?
And well, it would have been all like 60s. I was always a bit of a snob with my music selections. I was always trying to do what the other DJs weren't, I think, at that time. But I had read the book Mods by Richard Barnes, and I learned so much about the music Guy Stevens was playing at the same club. My sister Maggie living in London, you know, I said, Maggie, could you try and pick this record up for me, you know? And then my dad actually was told by a leading member of the UVF, which is a loyalist paramilitary group, and just pulled my dad aside and says, look, Jackie, I know you're not Republican, but your son's going to get shot. And my brother came home from work, and he was, his bags were packed, you know, and within 24 hours, he was living in Chicago. My dad had a brother who lived in Chicago. There's actually a, you know, the story gets happier. So he was living in Chicago. My mom used to go to Chicago and see him. So whatever I was into, I was like, Mom, get me some soul music, you know? So when I was like 15, my mom, she brought me back Ike and Tina Turner records and, you know, Sam and Dave records and these amazing like soul compilation. I was being introduced to people I knew nothing about,
yeah,
who are now seen as like complete legends, you know? That was also really handy as well in the late 80s because Acid House was born in Chicago.
Yeah, so tell me about when Acid House first kind of, I mean, I remember interesting hearing your music and just going, I haven't got a reference point for this because I hadn't dug into Kraftwerk and stuff. So when it arrived, I was like, this is completely new.
Well, it was a gradual thing. And then we can't deny the collaboration that was happening with this music and Ecstasy. And I'd been DJing in the later 80s, like 87, 88, with a guy called Ian McCready, who was like really influential to me and was always like really ahead of his time musically. He was a year older, but he was bringing all these imports in from New York, 80s kind of hip hop. But you could see that it was starting to change. I mean, we used to go to this club called The Delta, and there was this guy called Brian, who was the DJ, and he would be playing some of the early Chicago stuff. This is like 86. Like Love Can't Turn Around and, you know, those early sort of house records. Ecstasy culture hadn't happened yet.
I always think about those photos of the opening night of the Hacienda. The opening night looks like Phoenix Nights. It's just blokes in jumpers and everyone's sort of standing around with like a pint of bitter. Cut to what you're talking about and all of a sudden it's a very different scene.
Well, like growing up doing all those, a lot of those clubs like the Delta, the Plaza, Carpenters, they catered for like all the freaks in Belfast. Anyone who was a bit of a peacock, anyone that was different, punks, mods, skinheads, goths. And then you had sort of your gay crowd that were really sort of, you know, just open and flamboyant and fun. All these people just mixed. So you would hear Tainted Love next to The Cure, next to New Order. Then you'd hear Public Image, then you'd hear Janet Jackson, Gwen Guthrie, and, you know, so it was just this mad mix of people and music. You'd hear Nina Simone, My Baby Just Cares For You. It was like a massive anthem, but really just slow, moody track. But, like, I just always remember that completely filling the dance floor with everyone. But when Acid House happened, I think, well, I know what happened because I was there. Acid House was the kind of the unification.
Yeah.
Of all the tribes, you know, they all came together and suddenly people who were like really sort of sartorial minded had a pair of dungarees and a pair of comfy shoes. It was like almost like right back to sort of Northern Soul,
yeah,
where people were wearing clothes for comfort so they could dance.
Mm-hmm.
So I seen all these different freaks from all over Belfast just unite under the banner of Acid House, and that was beautiful, you know, to watch. You know, there's an argument, not an argument, but a discussion that I've heard a few times that Acid House was the beginning of the peace process in Northern Ireland. But it actually goes back much further than that. All these different clubs, like going back to the 70s, starting, like, say, with the punk movement and that, going into the new romantic and all these different sort of cultures. Religion wasn't an issue. Sectarianism wasn't an issue. The church was the club that you went to, and the people who you went there with, no matter where they were from in Belfast, they didn't want to talk about the troubles. I believe it goes back to all those little scenes. But then when Acid House happened, it was the unification of all those scenes. But also you had this added ingredient, which was ecstasy. And I used to see people from really hardcore loyalist and Republican neighborhoods who were people who you wouldn't mess with on a dance floor together. And that actually sort of changed a lot of people for the good. Didn't change everyone. It's a bit like in England, you know, like after all the people in, you know, who were fighting on the football terraces.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then Acid House completely changed them overnight. And a lot of them stayed, but some of them went back to their, like, evil ways.
Yeah.
As it were. So there was a real rough element to it as well. Like, when I was a young Acid House DJ, I was in Ibiza. I come back from Ibiza and my mum was in tears. I said, what's wrong? And two renegade members of the UVF had started getting involved in the clubs because where there's drugs, there's money.
Mm-hmm.
So they rang my mum up and told her I was a drug dealer and I was going to get shot. We had no mobile phones back then, so my mum couldn't ring me, going, what is going on? So I walked in, she was in tears, and I was just like, Mum, don't, this is, these people, I don't know what they're doing, but this is wrong. You know, I am not a drug dealer. Don't worry, you know. In Belfast being a small place, I quickly found out that it was two renegade sort of doormen at another club, and they were paramilitary, but they were, let's just say, they were acting in their own interests. And then on the Monday morning, we had a record shop called Sugar Sweet, in the same mm-hmm. as a club. I went into the record shop and they come in. Like, I just literally opened at 10 a.m. and these two men, you know, like, man, I was a child. They said, are you David Holmes? I was like, very stupidly said yes. And then they just totaled me and the shop. And I remember I paid myself, just because I thought I was getting shot, because that was just normal. So I very quickly found out who they were and what the attachment was. That was just their scare tactics to frighten me off. There was a moment where I was like leaving Belfast and I was going to go and live in Dublin or go and live in London. Well, once I got more information and I could see that they weren't going to shoot me, they were just trying to scare me, I just stood my ground and continued to put on club nights. And the aftermath of that definitely had a profound effect on me. You know, I used to sleep with the light on and I'd have escape routes in my mind mapped out, right? If they come in, I might run up there and, you know, like, that's
how your mind had to work.
That's how my mind was working. Because it was a reality, you know, like all that stuff that was happening. It wasn't inconceivable that I could get shot dead for encroaching on someone's pay packet. There was definitely that sort of darker element to it as well, but it definitely didn't stop us, you know. I closed the record shop. I couldn't go into the record shop again because it was like, I'm not getting in there. Because, you know, people are going to know where you are.
Exactly.
You know.
BBC Radio
6 Music.
All this month, we are busting through the January clouds together.
All day cloud busting.
Every Friday, we'll play uplifting listener requests and dedications to banish the clouds.
Music to sweep away the January blues.
And this Friday, we've got special guest mixes and playlists from Hack Baker, Amal Rajan, Andy and Makita Oliver, Ice Cube and Yard Act.
And you can catch up on previous week's mixes on BBC Sounds right now.
All day cloud busting this Friday.
Let's get some cloud control up in here.
Reasons to be cheerful.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with David Holmes.
Six music.
What was your first release? What was the first thing that came out with your name on it?
The first thing...
Why are you smiling like that? Is it an embarrassing one or is it...
I haven't heard it in a long time. I'm sure it is embarrassing. There was this guy called Brian Irvine. He was introduced to me by Ian McCready. And he says he's great. You know, he'll take you into his studio and he's really kind and generous and stuff. And he took me into his little recording studio in Bangor, which is about 20 minutes outside Belfast. At that stage, I was kind of like messing around with samples and stuff. Didn't have an ounce of technical ability. Didn't have any of the gear. But as a DJ, I knew how things worked and how you could definitely make something. So I went to his studio when he showed me, and it was just a real eye-opening experience for me, and we released it on Sugar Sweet Records.
What was it called?
You know what? I think I might have called myself Death Before Disco. And no disrespect to disco. I love disco.
Yeah.
But at that time, it just felt a bit punk. It just sounded cool to me, you know. And we put that out. Actually, he's just written the most amazing... string arrangements for the new Primal Scream record.
Ah.
He just won an Ivor Novello for an opera. You know, he saved up and moved to the West Coast to get an education at Berklee Music College. So, like, he's just a phenomenal talent, but an amazing human being. Someone I'm very proud to call my friend, you know, like, still teaches one day at the Tech in Derry, just helping kids to meet music, and these are different possibilities, and gets them all just to sing, and he still finds time to do that kind of thing. So his generosity of spirit is just phenomenal. So he was the first person who brought me into a recording studio, and now he's just done orchestrations for the new Primal Scream album, which is amazing.
Talking about exceptional humans, I wanted an excuse on the show to play Smoke Belch 2 remix, but when did you first meet Andrew Weatherall?
The first time I met Andrew Weatherall was in a club in London. I'd heard about him, you know, that he was this amazing DJ, and he wasn't like other DJs, you know. He was very unique in the way he kind of put records together and stuff, you know, and sequence records. And I just remember going to see him play and was just completely gobsmacked, and heard him play such a wide range of music in a very seamless way. I was just astounded by his choices, his technical skills, and how he kind of programmed the music, which is such, you know, it's a big part of DJing, you know. It's just like controlling the people's atmosphere and energy, and that's, I think that's what a great DJ masters. I was literally gobsmacked, and I ran up to him afterwards, you know. I was like 19 or 20. I was like, Andrew, like, that was just unbelievable. You know, my name's David Holmes. Would you come and play at my club in Belfast? And he says, I'd love to come to Belfast. And at that time, nobody wanted to come to Belfast, but Andrew had read all the books. Andrew probably knew more about the sort of Northern Irish history than a lot of people who lived there. Because he was just this consummate sort of reader. He was just devouring books, you know. So he already had a real interest in it. And he gave me his phone number and he says, give me a call during the week and we'll sort it out. And then I rang him up and he says, the Coronation Street's just started. Could you call me back in a half hour? So I waited for Coronation Street, and then I brought him to play at Sugar Sweet. And then from that moment, he became this legendary kind of figure. There's actually another young DJ at that time, this brilliantly gifted technical DJ called Glenn Malloy. He got really bad tinnitus, and it kind of cut his DJ career short, but he's a really great graffiti artist. And when Andrew passed, he did this really beautiful mural. But the way he did it was Andrew looking across the road as the art college, where we brought them for the first time. It's now been knocked down and rebuilt, and it's really beautiful what they've done actually, but it's just him looking over towards the Art College. So he left such, his paw marks are all over that city, and he's highly, highly respected. Not just for someone who educated us all and brought us on this wild journey. It's very layered, Andrew's respect, you know, because music was just something that he did. You know, he was beyond music, you know, he transcended music.
Film's crap, let's slash the seats. What do you remember about doing it? Because, you know, like, you've got the an album's an album, it's got your name above the door, all this expectation, is it going to go wrong, bit of ego, bit of pressure, bit of money. What do you remember from doing that record?
Well, that record single-handedly got me into the mind of filmmakers. That was definitely the catalyst. But it was, again, Andrew Weatherall, one of the most inspiring things he ever said to me and did for me was he urged me to find my own path and don't be the derivative of the derivative. You know, the same trajectory he had, which was going from a DJ to having absolutely no sort of technical knowledge, but having ideas and being able to go into a studio with an engineer and hire some musicians and sort of try and create, you know, a sound that you could sort of like put your own stamp on. So he really encouraged me to do that. I started delving in the soundtracks, and soundtracks that I grew up with that were in my parents and my brothers and sisters in their record collection, like Once Upon a Time in America and Midnight Cowboy. I was playing Once Upon a Time in America out, like just dropping it in over the top of like breakdowns, like DJ Hell, my definition of house music. But in the breakdown, dropping those pan pipes, and people really responded to it because such a recognisable soundtrack. And I was like, that's interesting, you know. So I took Andrew's advice really and went, this is my thing, you know. So I started using cinema as a form of inspiration and seeing the link between electronic music and film music. I already knew a lot, so I was able to kind of
tap into that 8-year-old boy that was watching all those VHSs. It was all there.
Yeah, for sure, you know. And I was able to go, yeah, that soundtrack being quite electronic, or, you know, and being able to sort of really sort of delve into that world and sort of bring that into my own world with drum machines and synths and stuff, you know. So I was sitting in a hotel room in Amsterdam with a bunch of friends. I was DJing over there, and someone just says, oh, this film's crap, let's slash the seats. And I was like, that's the title of my album. Right there. That's the title. Anyone got a pen? You know, you wrote it down and that was it. think that became like a calling card, really, for my initial work. That's what got me some experience. And then I suppose when I got my first American film, like big budget film with Steven Soderbergh, Out of Sight.
Good film.
They wanted me because of my second album, Let's Get Kills. But I think what got me the gig was because I'd already worked on a film.
Yeah.
So it was like, okay, well, he's worked on a film that, you know, because it's all about confidence. It was like, okay, he's done a film. All that stuff. It's all part of the tapestry, you know.
Yeah.
I think without that, I would never have had that opportunity, that first opportunity. And if I hadn't had that first opportunity, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to work with Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah, then you have Ocean's 11, you have, you know.
I'm actually doing a film with him next year.
Oh, that relationship is still ongoing. Yeah. That's lovely.
Yeah, no, I've done like 9 films with him now.
Yeah.
And a TV series.
95-pound Chinese man with $160 million behind this door.
Let's get him out.
Steven and I have it's just purely about the work relationship.
Yeah, why does it work? Because there's, what I think makes a lot of your film work interesting is the way that music obviously complements the scene, like all good soundtrack does, but sometimes you're not scared of just a big, like a song or a melody or a hook that kind of really does not compete with the visuals, but it's the two things meld together.
Yeah, I mean, I have been incredibly lucky to work with really great people who don't have a negative ego. They kind of create an atmosphere where I feel comfortable.
Right.
And they've also got good taste in music. So I always feel as if whatever I send to them, if I really like it, they'll like it.
It's going
to
be okay.
You know, and sometimes that doesn't work, but it is a gamble. You know, taking on a film, working on a film, it's the biggest collaborative art form in the world. You're just a cog in the wheel, right? So you have to make sure that your collaborators, you know, yous are all on the same page, because it's, you want it to be a fun and rewarding journey, not as a job, but as something that you actually feel really proud of.
Yeah.
So Stephen had always provided that platform and that atmosphere for me to feel really comfortable. And he's one of the smartest people I've ever met. Now we're at a point where he can just say one sentence to me and then that one sentence then allows me to go off and explore what he means and come back with essentially the guts of a soundtrack.
Yeah.
We've got that shorthand now. And I have a very simple logic about working with filmmakers, which is give what they're giving. Even though you're the music department, you have to care about it as much as the director does.
Yeah.
If you do the best you can and you do a good job, someone will give you another job. You know, that's the way I think. And with Steven, I've always just tried to give what he gives. And a lot of the times I overcompensate, like when I did the movie The Laundromat, which is, you know, he asked me to do the score and I basically sent him 350 tracks of other people's music. Because Stephen comes from New Orleans. He spent part of his early life there. So that sort of rootsy, gutsy R&B is in his bones. And I just sent him, like, I sent him 350 tracks, and I ended up, I did two pieces of score, because he says, I'm sorry, but all that music you sent me was so bloody good, I've actually just cut it into the whole soundtrack.
Six Music.
Well, I got the phone call asking me to do the show.
Hugh Stevens.
I sat on the floor and cried like a baby. A very happy, emotional baby. And so to be part of the Six Music family on air with you, the listeners,
means the world.
It's about the whole culture, from the record shop to the gig venue, celebrating live music in all its forms. Talking to the legendary and emerging musicians. I'll play as many brilliant tunes as I possibly can, live and direct from my hometown of Cardiff. So finish the day and start your evening with me,
Hugh Stevens.
Tuesday to Friday afternoon from 4.
Six Music.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with David Holmes.
Six Music.
Wonders. There's some songs that, like, and it is a cliche, but some songs exist far wider than where they were created. And the cliche of, like, well, we don't own those songs anymore, the public owns those songs. It's a cliche because it's kind of true. And that is one of those songs that's just gone off. It's a track that's had its own life, that people who know nothing about you from worlds that are not connected to your world of DJing and soundtracks still know that song.
Yeah.
And that's... that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, it's lovely to hear that.
Yeah.
You know, I've never really looked at it in that way. I know it was a track that slipped through the cracks and was reignited through Danny Boyle and the Olympics and stuff. And that really sort of, like, resurrected the song, as it were. I mean, it's always had great support, especially on Six Music, but yeah, it's definitely come back in different ways.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a song that it means a lot to a lot of people. And how that song came together, I had the title before I made the song, and I was looking for guest singers to work with. Actually, one of the people who I approached was Martin Rev from Suicide, and he wrote, you know, some lyrics based on that title. And then my dad died. And when my dad died, what was really interesting and weird was that I was much closer to my mum. And I got closer to my dad, especially after my mum died. But his death had a profound effect on me. And I think it was the realization that you were an orphan. You no longer had your parents. Not something that you think about when they're around, but once they're gone, I think that's when all the stuff that you've been burying, all the stuff that you've actually taken for granted, all rises to the surface. So I'm an avid note taker, you know. I was just writing down loads of notes. And one of those notes was I Heard Wonders. And as I was kind of like grieving, it was a tough time, actually, you know, I think back, because it really surprised me, the effect it was having on me. I started to play around with what would I sound like if I sang, you know, and I had these notes that turned into lyrics. And I worked out that I can manage to actually make myself sound okay because I've got a studio at home and a mic. And when my wife went out to sort of work and my daughter was at primary school at that point, I could just let my inhibitions go and try and sort of figure out a way for me to express myself, but make it sound listenable. Another Weatherall, going back to Weatherall, you know, he always said to me, you know, like, if you go into your studio, like, it doesn't matter if you can't sing or, like, in inverted commas, if you just go and let something out and it comes from the bottom of your heart, no one can take that away from you.
Yeah.
And that was in my mind, hey, you know what, I can do this. And then I started writing. I'd written, like, the first verse and the chorus, and then I remembered Martin Rev's words. So I ended up writing verses, half a chorus, and then what Martin was writing about was something, like, I don't know what was going on in his mind, but it totally sort of fitted to what I was saying about the loss of my parents and how I think about them when they're not there and dream about them. And, you know, my mom was an incredible woman, like, you know, so progressive for a woman who was born in 1924 and brought 10 kids into the world. She was really progressive in her thinking. Where my dad was so much more traditional and like, get a job, get a real job, you know. My mom was like, do whatever you want, just be happy. Like, my mom was just really kind of like, I've already been there 9 times. So I know that, like, your happiness is the most important thing. So she always urged me, and she never seen any wrong in me, you know. I think I was the first child that she could actually enjoy, because all my brothers and sisters had got to an age where they could all have designated jobs and help, you know, hold the baby, you know. So all the other kids were all doing the beds and helping clean the house, and everybody had a job. Like, you do the dishes, you dry the dishes, you set the table, you know. So the song was about remembering them, really. And then I managed to sort of get it down and sing it and make it sound good. And the first person I played it to was Andrew.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And it really sort of blew his mind. He loved it. He actually remixed I Heard Wonders, which is an amazing remix. And that just gave me so much more confidence, you know, just knowing that somebody that I profoundly respected not only inspired me and helped me have the nerve to actually be able to sing myself, but then for him to say, are you kidding me? You know. one funny story surrounding this, because Andrew had already started singing.
Yeah.
He did it first, you know. Of course he did. I remember we were on the phone one night, and he was laughing because someone had, I think it was, reviewed one of his records that he was singing on, but credited me as the first DJ ever to sing. But like, he's just like, the two of us were laughing. I was going, oh my God, I'm completely mortified, you know, because I knew that it was him. I'm going, just do it yourself, man. The most important thing is that you do it from your heart. Nobody can take that away from you. If your words are true to you and you believe in them, then the worst thing anyone can say is they don't like it.
Yeah.
So you kind of become review proof in a way.
Yeah.
As long as you abide by that number one rule, like, do not put out anything if you're not prepared to stand behind it and be proud of it. And then it just becomes a matter of like, I really like it. I think it's rubbish, you know. Okay, well, you know, I did the best I could, and that's all that really matters, really, at the end of the day. But, you know, it's great, of course, when you get support and people actually do buy into what you're doing and support your music and play it on the radio and play it at clubs, and you get people coming up and saying, I love that track, and, you know, that means so much.
And the final question, and it is an easy one, what should we go out on? What track should we finish on?
Well, I'd like to sort of not waste this opportunity of doing some shameless self-promotion.
Do it. It's your show, man. It's your show.
I'm going to ask you to play a track from my new album, and that track is going to be Emotionally Clear.
Why that song?
It's just a song that I'm really proud of, that I wrote during lockdown, and it's a song that kind of reflects the times that we were living in during COVID, but has still reflects the times now more than ever.
Yeah.
I've actually got a version of me singing this song, which I might release one day, because it was one of those ones where I was actually happy that I got my voice sounding good. But then Raven just comes in and completely makes it her own, and, you know, her voice is just off the scales. So it's also sort of inspired by the Mamas and Papas, like the three-part harmonies and stuff just in the chorus. And that was something I always wanted to do, but I got to do it with a girl who's not only my goddaughter, but is from the West Coast. And she has just got that inbuilt West Coast tone to her voice.
Yeah.
And it was a track that I did with a local guitar player called Joe Green. And he used to just come to my house sometimes and we'd just like jam and record stuff. We recorded this, just this loop one night and kind of forgot about it. And then went back to it and it was like, I love this loop. And then one day I just got the loop and turned it into a whole track and played all the keys. And I remember just going, this is one of those moments, you know, and it's, so that became Emotionally Clear.
And that's the song we'll finish on. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Emotionally Clear by David Holmes featuring Raven from David's most recent album, Blind on a Galloping Horse. And thank you to David for being my guest on the first time this evening. And that is the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Beth Ditto. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from this season on BBC Sounds, which include my chats with John Grant, Holly Johnson, Kate Le Bon, and Stormzy. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.